This is the Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93XFM here in Minneapolis and uprocks.com. I'm your host, Stephen Hayden. Today, my guest is Dave Liapepe from the band Gang of Youths. And depending on where in the world you are listening to this podcast, this is either a big guest or maybe it's an unknown guest to you. But if it's the latter, I'm thinking this episode will change it. You know, I think you will become a convert as I am and as other people in the world are. If you are listening in Australia, and I know that we have Australian listeners, I hear from them on Twitter, Gang of Youths is one of the biggest young bands in that country right now. This is a band that topped the record charts in that country. They win the equivalent of Grammys. I think they won 8 or so in the most recent round. Here in America, however, Gang of Youths is a band that is still catching on. And in 2017, they put out a record called Go Farther in Lightness. And it was the first record by this band that I had ever heard. And it just blew me away. I mean, this was a band that seemed to synthesize so many different things about anthemic rock and roll from the last 20 years. You know, especially, I guess, indie rock of the 2000s. Think of a band that could somehow merge Nationals' Boxer and Alligator period with The Rat by The Walkmen. You know, like that's what a lot of the songs by this band sounds like. And yet there's a poeticism and a passion to Dave's lyrics that makes it totally the band's own. I started writing about the band last year. I interviewed Dave for a story on uprocks.com. And, you know, at that time, not a lot of people were talking about this band here in America. There wasn't a whole lot going on with the record. Gang of Youths actually toured America right when that record came out last year. And no one really showed up. It was one of those things. You know, I'm in Minneapolis, and they played the 7th Street Entry here, and Dave said that like 20 people showed up when they played here in 2017. But when I caught up with Dave a couple weeks ago, they were back at the 7th Street Entry, and they sold the place out. It was super packed. And not only was it sold out, but there was an energy in the room that was really incredible. I don't want to go over the top here with overselling this band, but there's a passion to this band and an excitement to this band. It reminds me of like early U2 or like Pearl Jam when they were on like the 10 tour, you know, like before they really blew up, when they were just playing clubs. You know, there was hysteria around those bands because they were big sounding bands. They were future arena bands essentially, and they were playing small clubs, but they were packing the energy of an arena show into a club. And that's what Gang of Youths did on its latest tour. They just finished a leg of their American tour. They're going to be back on the road, I know. They may already be back by the time this podcast posts. But if you know Gang of Youths is coming to your town, I implore you to go see this band. First, you want to check out Go Farther in Lightness, because that's a great record. But see them live. I think their live show has the power to win over converts. They're definitely one of the more exciting rock bands that I've seen in a while. And, you know, Dave is a really nice guy. He's a really thoughtful guy. He cares a lot about rock and roll. He has a lot of things to say about rock and roll. You know, we met up, we talked for a while, then I turned the microphone on, and we talked for about an hour, and then I turned it off and we talked for another hour. You know, just had a great time getting together. So this was a great conversation. I think you guys are going to really like this episode. Before we get to that, I just want to talk about a couple things. First of all, my book, Twilight of the Gods, comes out in a month on May 8th. And if you're a listener of this podcast, you know I've been running ads for the book for a while now, trying to get the word out. You know, this is a platform I helped to build, so I want to use this platform to promote this book. I'm really proud of it. I think if you enjoy this podcast, you will enjoy the book. It's a book about classic rock mythology, sort of the rise and fall of that culture. It discusses bands like Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, AC/DC, Black Sabbath, all these classic bands, and how the culture that those bands helped to create we're sort of in the process of seeing go away. You know, a lot of these bands are either retiring from the road. You know, we've had a lot of rock stars who have passed away recently. And, you know, for me, like when I was a kid, I mean, these rock bands, they were like my Marvel superheroes. You know, I didn't read comic books. I read Hammer of the Gods. I read No One Here Gets Out Alive. You know, all these trashy rock books. Those were my comic books, and these were my heroes. So I wrote about, you know, what it's like to grow up like that and now to be in the process of witnessing a lot of those heroes start to fade away a bit. So that's my book, Twilight of the Gods. It comes out in a month. You can pre-order now wherever you buy books. And I would really appreciate it if you did that. And before we get to the Dave interview, I want to talk about something else here. And that is our old friends at SeatGeek. They are sponsoring today's episode. Buying tickets can be complicated and confusing, but there is a better way to buy with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to every kind of live event. Whether you're searching for a last-minute deal, planning a night out with friends, or need to find the perfect gift, SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. There's nothing quite like being there in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. Now, I've used the SeatGeek app myself. It's a good way to get deals. It's very convenient. It's easy to use. It's right there on your phone. You know, buying tickets can be a hassle, but this is a very easy way to do it. Now, for my listeners, I have a special deal. If you download the SeatGeek app and you enter in the promo code CELEBRATION, you will get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Again, enter in the promo code CELEBRATION into the app, and you get $20 off your ticket. So, you know, I know you guys like live music. If you're going to buy a ticket anyway, this is a way to get $20 off a ticket. So again, go to SeatGeek, enter in promo code CELEBRATION, you get the cheap ticket, you support the podcast, everyone wins. Okay, so here was me and Dave from Gang of Youths. We got into it, we talked, we hung out at a bar next to the 7th Street entry, and we talked about everything. We talked about the band's career, we talked about personal stuff. It got heavy at times, but I think it was really great. We had a good time. So here is me and Dave from Gang of Youths talking on the Celebration Rock podcast. So I feel bad because, you know, you've written about this in your songs about sobriety and the need to be sober, and we're talking in a bar, and I'm drinking like two drinks in front of you.
No. I'm one of those people who, yeah.
But is it hard to be on tour, though?
Yeah.
Like, how do you deal with that?
My wife doesn't drink, so it's not like a huge thing. Like, occasionally my wife and I will have like a glass of wine together at a very special event, like when we got married and shit. But for me, it's kind of like my life is better when I'm not under the influence, and so I understand, like, you know, it's a sacrifice for my personal and mental well-being, but also it amplifies my ability to do my job correctly. You know, it's very difficult to tour when I'm drinking. It's very difficult for me to sing the way that I sing if I'm, you know, if I'm using alcohol as a lubricant for my vocal folds. It doesn't fucking work. It dehydrates you. It's like, and just a whole bunch of practical reasons why not drinking is actually fine on tour. But one of the boys in the band is an enormous beer nut, and he always has this really great beer on hand, and I always get kind of jealous that he gets to try all the fucking seasonal delights. So that's not the only thing, but really fine. I struggled so much with drinking that it's just eliminating it from my life basically completely has been really rewarding. But I don't know, it's sort of like, it's, you know, it's kind of a struggle.
Like, how long have you been sober?
On and off. Not long, like on and off for a year, but it's kind of like, I think I'm going to do it permanently. Just because, since the beginning of the year, just because my wife doesn't drink, and I'm like, I don't know, I don't want to allow it to affect my life in the way that it used to.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, like, was there ever a time in your life where you felt like, I'm in a band, so I need to drink,
to live a life? Yeah, dude, fuck yeah. It was like, I needed to cope with the sheer anxiety of having to work with other people and, like, function in society as a person, you know? And being in a band, there's that external pressure, but not necessarily culturally. I was never really drawn to the sex, drugs, rock and roll mythology because I always found that to be kind of fucking pretentious, and it killed so many people I admired. But I think just something about the self-destruction felt therapeutic for a while. It felt like a means to create rather than something that was destroying my ability to create. And that's a weird thing, like when you become reliant on something that is fucking killing you in order to produce things that you find worthwhile. And to be completely honest, man, like a lot of things I wrote when I was under the influence of like prescription drugs or alcohol, like I don't hate it, but I don't necessarily feel like that just for me personally. It's like a correct and true representation of what I want to be or who I want to be, you know what I mean? So I think there's a lot of like kind of philosophical reasons that I think sobriety like kind of works for me. And I don't know if it'll come and go forever, but...
Like, was this last record, Go Farther in Lightness, was that a sober record?
No. No. It was a lot of drinking and crying and loneliness. But that's the thing, man. Like, it took a lot out of me. Like,
it's a hopeful record, though, yeah. Ultimately. But were those just pep talks for yourself, in a way?
Yeah. I think a lot of people say it's, like, the only self-help record, like, that they could listen to without it feeling, like, cheesy, which is hilarious, because I think a lot of the album's quite cheesy in a way. Because these are empowering sentiments you can find in all the great philosophers, you know, like Hegel, Heidegger, obviously Nietzsche. I think all these components and all these, like, all these things encased within Go Farther in Lightness are meant to be really hopeful, and they serve a real purpose that actually has function in your life. Like, I believe that we should never let our spirit wane. I believe that we should always say yes to life. That's a Nietzschean affirmation.
Yeah.
You know? These are things that are just like kind of like slyly packaged as, you know, cheesy Anthony Robbins catch-alls, but really I think they encapture real like beautiful axioms and truths about what it is to really live, to be like a person, to fucking exist.
Like, did you feel like you actually believed that though when you were writing it, or were you like willing yourself to believe it?
I didn't fucking believe any of it. No, no, that's the thing. Like, part of the affirmations, like the repetition of this affirmation is to like compel yourself toward believing it, to compel yourself toward like some sense of momentum, you know? It's one of those things that I always used to call it the wiggle your big toe idea. Uma Thurman's saying, wiggle your big toe.
From Kill Bill,
yeah. And she just has to wiggle her big toe. Then now that the hard part's over, and then she finally manages to break through and regain the use of her legs. And I think that's a beautiful image for, you know, not all the time, but sometimes when we don't believe these empowering sentiments, to just try to utilize some of them. Utilize some of them. Utilize one to kind of get the engine, you know, engine moving a little bit. It probably errs maybe on a dangerous side of like self-help bullshit. But
I mean, you said that, like, you've said self-help bullshit. You've said cheesy.
Yeah.
We're talking about your own record,
yeah.
But like, it is fascinating to me how much great rock and roll really rides that line of like, if you teeter just a little bit, it's a disaster, you know. Like, I just did this series on the podcast about Bruce Springsteen, and like tons
of
Bruce.
That's the ultimate self-help manual.
Yeah. Or like, yeah, like Born to Run. There's so many moments on that record where you're like, this could have been terrible.
Keep working until it's understood, till these bad lands start treating us good.
Right.
That's like, you know.
What's the How do you pull yourself onto the good side of that? Because I think a lot of great music, a lot of great rock and roll, like, it has to ride that line. If it doesn't ride that line, if it doesn't have that kind of conviction, it doesn't really move people. But you can also be horribly embarrassing at the, you
yeah.
know, if you don't do
it
right.
It can be mawkish, right? It can be mawkish. I think people should look toward Titus Andronicus and Japandroids and bands that... And, I guess the Gaslight Anthem to an extent. Bands that employed this, all these empowering sentiments with a sense of, like... resignation to the fates. Like, a sense of fatalism is probably really important when it comes to the rock and roll myth of like empowering music, you know. And to me, like, to avoid the cheese, you just have to like find the most relatable and the most human way to explain big cosmological problems and big fucking philosophical issues. You know, the most human and relatable thing, the thing that is uniting and bonding about music. I think that's what stops it from being like mawkish and overly trite and overly sentimental. And I think it's a real difference you can tell when something's like an authentic expression of like overcoming, an authentic expression of superseding something, and something that's just there cynically to gaslight people into believing that they're achieving something. You know, like, I think that's a real... there's a real definable way to look at it, you know, because you hear like any kind of top 40 anthem that feels authentic and feels, you know, really empowering, and then you can tell the difference between that and something that's just a cynical fucking, you know, like money grab capitalizing on the base impulses of progressive America. Like, that's like, you know, that's a really definable thing. Like,
that's the next album title, by the way, The Base Instincts of Progressive America.
Dude, The Base Instincts of Progressive America are coming to a head, I think. But,
hey, you want to dig into your pasta here?
Oh, yeah.
They're playing Jock Jams behind us right now.
I know. This feels very working in a steel mill.
Episode of The Simpsons?
What's that?
You ever seen that episode of The Simpsons?
Oh, yeah.
We work hard, we play hard.
So is this like, I know you played 7th Street Entry like right when the record came out, right? Is this the second time or did you play before that?
This is the second time. I have like a adolescent fascination with this city, primarily because of, you know, Bob Mould and Husker Du and The Replacements. So the first time we played this, I made like a big deal about it, and I'm going to make a big deal about it again. I don't know, it's just, I don't know what it is about Minnesota, man. I don't know what it is about Minneapolis especially. I don't know if it's like cities that have a history of like blue collar working class populace or, but I don't know.
Then you have Prince, who's like from another planet but happened to live in Minneapolis, you know, just this.
Dude, I mean, Prince fucking shot Purple Rain in there, man. I mean, that's like, I don't know, I think like the musical iconography of the city is really, really vital and important to me. Like the first time I came here, I stood on the corner of 9th and Hennepin. And if anyone's a Tom Waits nerd, they'll understand why. You know? It's the second time I've been here, but I don't know, something always feels electric about Minneapolis. I don't know.
Well, like, the reason I asked is that I know tonight's show is sold out. Like, how many people were at that first show?
20. Like, 20.
It seems like this tour, I mean, is the tour they're on right now, is this the best American tour you've done so far, like most successful?
Yeah, by a fucking long shot, dude. God.
It seems like a lot of the shows are sold out. I have
to. Dude, we were the Cubs here for a while, man. Like, just nothing but losses. Yeah, we had the Sox, Ghost of the Bambino. Like, we had nothing but L's on this continent. And we've been a band for 6 years. We toured America a lot. We just never really hit it. And I think, yeah.
Like when you play for 20 people, are you like discouraged before you go out? Are you just like, well, fuck it, it doesn't matter, we're gonna play a great show? Like, what is the mindset in a situation like that?
My Joy Division started in a room of 20 people in a Sex Pistols show, Manchester City Trade Hall. I always tell the boys, you don't play rooms hoping that people show up. You play rooms hoping that people show up, see you show up. You know the electricity in a room of 10 people who feel, you know, like they're really seen by a band, who feel like they're having a night where the band gives a fuck about them. Like, I remember that feeling of going to hardcore punk shows with 7-8 kids and feeling like we're all part of this amazing thing. I don't give a fuck how many people are there, man. Like, it doesn't need to be 20,000. 20 people is enough. Like, there's something like it's like the most intoxicating rock and roll feeling in the whole world to be part of a moving, shaking, beating heart inside a room, you know? And if there's 20 people, that's amazing. And I always think, like, I always think about not what is happening for us at that moment, but I was thinking about, like, there's gonna be like a fucking teenager in there who's gonna go and pick up a guitar, maybe, you know, who's gonna pick up a drum kit, or even gonna buy a laptop or start making music. Like, do you know how fucking badly we wanted to be the band that caused little kids to pick up their instruments?
You know? but like, all that said, it is cooler to have a sold out show, isn't it?
Yeah, fuck yeah, like, it's rad. Like, the atmosphere is like, so it's fucking right. But I don't know, I still love the empty rooms, because that's where a band cuts their teeth. That's where, as an artist, I learned how to believe in what I was doing. You don't learn how to believe what you're doing if you're constantly told how fucking great it is. You're convinced that what you're doing might be potentially beautiful if there isn't much enthusiasm, if people just shrug their fucking shoulders and look at you like you're an idiot, you know?
I mean, because, like, in Australia, or, like, in other parts of the world, like, you're playing what, like... like arenas probably, or like large theaters?
Australia plays 7,000, which is embarrassing to admit to anybody in America. I don't know.
Why? Why is that?
Because I didn't want to be this fucking big-ass band. We didn't really intend for it, and it happened, which is really nice.
Because you're like winning like the Australian Grammys over there. So you're like this Grammy-winning or ARIA-winning band, chart-topping band, you know, in Australia. I mean, is there any whiplash, like, when you go from that situation to playing in, like, a smaller club in America?
No, because I love the small clubs. Like, I didn't have ambitions to be the biggest band in the world. We didn't. We don't give a shit about being the biggest. We just want to be the fucking best. Like, there's nothing about us that should work. We're all different. We're all fucking kids who grew up in a youth group. Like, we're all kids from different cultures, origins. I mean, I grew up dirt poor. There's nothing about us that spells out fucking success. But it was like, we wanted to come together in some kind of spirit of, like, adventure and creativity to be, like, the very best version of what we were, you know? And I guess we wanted to make our own broken social scene in that way, you know? We wanted to become, like, you know, more than just parts of the sum. We wanted to make the sum of our parts huge.
Right.
You know, that makes sense.
So which...
Sort of, yeah, we sort of be the best, I guess.
I mean, that makes sense to me, but at the same time, like, I listen to your record, and there's just such a hugeness to the sound. Like, I hear Do Not Let Your Spirit Wane, and I'm like, okay, this should be heard in an arena with, like, 20,000 lighters up in the air, you know? Like, it has that kind of scale, like, you know, musically and emotionally... That sort of, like, let's do this on a big level.
Yeah, no, I understand.
I mean, do you have, like, conflicting impulses?
Probably. I've always fought against the idea of success because I'm terrified of what that'll bring me. Like, when we started to get really successful in Australia, I had nothing but, like, horrible anxiety about the prospect of, you know, people asking for photographs and, like, anything I fucking tweet being turned into a fucking news item. You know, that's horrifying. Like, the last thing I ever wanted was to be quote-unquote famous or whatever. And that still frightens the shit out of me. So maybe there's a bit of that. Maybe it's a bit of, like, self-sabotage. But I think more than that, like, we talk about doing like your spirit lane. I think the music that we love is really big music. As a band, collectively, our influences are Bruce Springsteen, Sonic Youth, U2, you know? Like, TV on the Radio. This is big music. And I think you can't help but want to... attempt to make that, even if you don't intend on playing Radio City Music Hall, even if you're happy with six Mercury Lounges, like, and I think that it's the music that we believe could have potential to really reach people, to break through a sense of fucking cynicism or apathy or this kind of, like, you know, resistance to anything that might entail some kind of humanity or might require you to drop your resistance, you know? Like, we feel like making music that somehow breaks through that, you know? That breaks through the lens of the cool, you know? And that music does have the potential to reach people, you know? I mean, you have to bring it up, like, Funeral by Arcade Fire. It wasn't a cool album. It's mawkish, it's sentimental, it's weepy, it's triumphant, and it's filled with all the stuff that indie rock tried to shed.
Right.
And then Arcade Fire became Arcade Fire. So I always think about, like, how are we piercing through the cool and trying to find something meaningful in this, and if that reaches a lot of people, then let's try and do it. But it was never, like, the intention to be, like, this big band or anything.
Okay, we're going to get back to the conversation here in a minute, but before we do, I want to tell you about one of our sponsors for this week. It is our old friends at Blue Apron. Now, Blue Apron is offering our listeners $30 off your first delivery. When it comes to dinner, let Blue Apron take care of the planning and shopping while you do the cooking and the eating. You'll enjoy delicious meals like popcorn chicken with sweet chili cabbage slaw and cumin-spiced wonton noodles with vegetables. Ooh, I have to take a breath after reading that delicious dish. So many elements. It sounds complicated, but with Blue Apron, they make it easy for you. They bring you these delicious ingredients right to your door. They tell you how to make it, and within like a half hour, 45 minutes, you have a delicious meal for you and your family. Now, for my listeners, we have that special deal again. That's $30 off. All you have to do is go to blueapron.com/celebration. Again, that's blueapron.com/celebration, and you're going to get $30 off this week's menu. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Okay, let's get to me and Dave on the Celebration Rock podcast.
I mean, we were talking before we started recording about, like, I was calling it lifestyle music, where it's like music that you hear in the background at a party or like in a clothing store, but it's never the focal point of like your day. And it seems like, you know, Spotify is geared towards that. There's like a lot of playlists about music to play when you're doing the laundry, you know, but there aren't, you know, but like music that is going to dominate your life. Like, that's not really the thing that's being pushed now. And, you know, I know when I heard your record, what I responded to was like, okay, this band's going for broke. You know, like, they're swinging for the fences, and like, this is epic music. They're trying to make a fucking masterpiece with this, and I really responded to it. Even if the record had been less successful, I think I would have wanted to embrace it for that reason. But I mean, it seems like a lot of music that kind of gets talked about is, again, I call it lifestyle music, but it's not like
low stakes. It's low stakes.
Right.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead. Like, I was like, that's the end of my monologue there. But like, I mean, I feel like your record is kind of a reaction against that in a way.
It's so weird. I feel the world with all these like all these fatalistic soliloquies about how this is like a last step, like Gang of Youths, this last ditch attempt to try and make something meaningful out of a flaccid, depressing life or whatever. Like, but I genuinely believe that everything we do must be better than the previous. That everything we do must be an attempt at a masterpiece. And I'm not one of those people who can just shit out a fucking great song about, you know, getting shit-faced at a club. I don't know how to do that. I have no fucking idea how to write something that isn't intrinsically tied to my humanity, my life. You know, I don't have the skill set for that. I don't know how to fucking do that. What I do know how to do is make, like, convoluted, enormous, like, ambitious things. Like, that's what I love. Those are the things that I care about, and like, I care about its potential reach. I think when it comes to like what you call lifestyle music, I call low stakes music. It's kind of the same thing. Like, our propensity for risk is decreasing with our in correlation to our increasing amount of comfort, and I guess our self-awareness is decreasing too, to the point where like there's so much chaos and confusion and terror with modernity that we're looking for things to either quell our anxieties or to subdue us, to make us feel relaxed, or to do drugs to. I mean, it's all about avoiding modern life and avoiding life, or at least engaging with mundanity as a means for marketing.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of stuff that's like, oh, I did this today and I did that today and all, like, my relationships are working out, but it's not necessarily an accurate portrayal or reflection of what real humanness is about. It's just like name-checking certain things that are vaguely relatable for the sake of the free market, right. Which is fine too, but I don't know how to do that. Like,
and again, I don't want to sound like some like troglodyte, Luddite, anti-technology person, because like, I stream music, I use streaming services, but I do feel like, you know, like, the format of music influences how music is presented or conceptualized. You could see, like, in the 60s, like, when the LP became the thing, bands made, vinyl-oriented records, like, sequence records, a side A, a side B. It influenced how the music was made. And I feel like with streaming, there's so much, it's about going with the flow. It's about, you know, does your song fit on a playlist where it won't stick out too much? It won't be abrasive or it won't be too strange. And I hear a lot of music that seems to be made with that in mind, and it's like, then you hear your record and it's like, oh no, this is like an 8-minute chamber pop piece, you know, with like, it's like Eleanor Rigby with, you know, crossed with like Where the Streets Have No Name type thing. And it's like, you can't really throw that in a indie rock playlist without it sticking out like a sore thumb, and yet that's the best thing about it.
I think there's like a painful acknowledgement that we stick out like sore thumbs wherever, because they're not a bunch of like skinny white dudes. Like, I don't know, people at home, but I'm 6'2", I'm brown, and I'm kind of big looking. We got a very, very big black guy playing guitar and a Korean American on keys. We already stick out. We don't have a fucking choice. We literally don't have a choice. Like, it was not something that like was a decision that we made together collectively as a group. Like, let's do that. I think that would be like a horrible crime against what we're trying to do anyway, to fucking blend in. I don't know. I like streaming because it just means that the world has infinite access to the Discord back catalog.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I
absolutely.
Think, you know, I grew up in a Christian household and I had to go fucking download shit on LimeWire. You know, sorry FCC and US government, but I did.
Right.
Like, I downloaded albums and albums worth of stuff on LimeWire, you know, because that's how I found out about it.
Well, it's wild. I remember when I was 13, I had this fantasy that I would have every record ever made in my basement and I could just go down and play it. And it's like, that's now reality and it seems so mundane.
Dude, isn't it strange how all these amazing advancements in music industry and technology and shit just seems so passe to us now? Like, oh yeah, it's just Apple Music, or yeah, it's just Pandora, just Spotify. I think the enormity of what this means is just we're gonna have to figure out ways to use these. I like these platforms a lot. We're gonna have to use these platforms for, you know, to be reductive, for good and not evil. And I think it's the responsibility of artists to attempt to do that and not try to capitulate to the fucking frustrating norms. All of us have to do it sometimes. Like, it's just an unavoidable reality. But I think it's up to artists, people like me. It's the onus is on me to attempt to try and use these things for, like I said, good or not evil. And I don't want to waste the opportunity that I have as someone who, you know, is relatively well streamed, by
well streamed,
well streamed, yeah, well streamed. To just shrug my fucking shoulders and be like, "Well, I've done that," and just rest on my laurels and start making like easily digestible stuff. And that's weird because I got a mate of mine who works at Spotify. Her name's Ali, and she's like, she's kind of an encyclopedia. She's got the most extraordinary knowledge of rock and roll. I don't know anyone like that. And she spends all this time listening to music, listen. And I think she's kind of one of the people in streaming world who really understands that in order for someone to be really good, that someone that deserves to be successful, it needs to feel relatively different. It needs to not feel run of the mill. So I think there's like, I think there's people like that who do exist within streaming world, you know. Like, Ali's fucking rad. I don't know. I do think it's like my responsibility to keep trying to, you know, pull people toward meaningful music within these platforms. You know, I can't rely on anyone else to do it. I want to do it.
So, let's talk about your childhood, Dave. Let's do a hard transition from... Where are you from originally?
I'm from the inner west of Sydney. So, it's like the really gentrified part of Sydney now. So, for people who live in New York, the proximity that I lived toward, like, in terms of like how far away I live from a city, I lived in Bushwick. So that's in terms of proximity. Most of the inner west where I grew up, very, very wealthy, gentrified now. It used to be kind of working class, like 20, 30 years ago. So I'm from the inner city there.
Did you have a good childhood or a bad childhood?
I had a childhood. You know what I mean? My parents did their fucking best. My dad stayed home. My mom raised us on disability, and she worked for like a bunch of charities and shit when I was a kid, and she didn't earn very much money. And she was the child of Holocaust survivors who fled Vienna via Shanghai, and they went to Australia. So my opa and oma, Fred and Sabine, or Fritz and Tinny, they settled in Sydney in the western suburbs, and my oppa was blinded in an accident, so he was completely blind for 60 something years. So my mom grew up pretty poor, and yeah, I suppose that kind of informed a lot of her life. And she always worked in social work and worked for charities. She worked for this one charity for the friends and relatives of people who had mental illnesses. And so I didn't grow up with money, you know, so that was kind of shitty. And my particular neighborhood was surrounded by nice stuff and shit stuff. I kind of grew up at, like, right near a train station, which is where a lot of the sketchy shit happens, so it wasn't, like, the most fun, but it was fine, you know. I went to church a lot. So my parents tried to insulate us from a lot of stuff that was happening, like, in reality, and I suppose church helped that. And I, you know, I played sport. I didn't have a great time in school, but who the fuck does, you know?
So,
yeah, nothing stupid. But, yeah, just good. There's nothing that strange about my story. Like, immigrant family, like, not a whole lot of money, like...
I mean,
I mean, do you feel like that put a chip on your shoulder at a young age to, like, I'm going to fucking kick people's asses as an adult, like, in a rock and roll band?
You have no idea. No idea. It's just, like, I think I've always had a chip on my shoulder. It's something I'm trying to lose because I feel like...
Me too.
Yeah, fuck you, man. Yeah. No, I get you.
Like, you... I was going to say, because I grew up, like, lower middle class, raised by a single mom, and, like, you know...
Single income family, man. I feel that, man. Single income family. Like, yeah. There's something about growing up in a single-income family, like, seeing everyone else who has stuff.
Right.
Especially in church, man, like, bougie fucking white people with all their shit, and, like, you know, I don't know.
And you have, like, shitty clothes, and, like, you know.
I mean, yeah, just, like, but it's normal shit, like.
Right.
Yeah, it's normal shit for people who don't have money. I wouldn't even say we're lower middle class, because middle class implies a sense of, middle class implies a sense of class. I don't think we really had much of it.
Right.
Just, I don't know, like, in Australia, the architecture of class is really different because, you know, we have universal healthcare, our welfare system's pretty good, we don't have gun crime anymore, not since the early 90s, really. We do have a gang problem, a lot of ethnic gangs, and I'm Pacific Islander, so there's a lot of that that goes on, especially, like, kind of nearabouts where I grew up and where I grew up. So I think those are the issues that we kind of face, but I guess the mechanics of class work and function really differently over there, so I think class there is more about earning power, and we didn't have any.
Yeah,
so I think it was like a... I think that always, like, maybe put a... Yeah, like I said, I really don't like the chip on my shoulder. It's not something I'm fucking proud of. You know, it made me bitter, and it made me judgmental against people I shouldn't have, you know.
But at the same time, that it's such a powerful tool.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a demon, and, like, also, like...
It's a blessing or a curse thing, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, do you remember, like, was there, like, a lightning bolt moment for you in terms of, like, I will now be a rock and roller?
My parents, they saved $10 a week for 25 weeks to buy me my first electric guitar. And I was having an interview with my mate Rod Yates. He's Rolling Stone Australia. And I actually burst into tears telling this story because I'd never really told him before. No, but it was just something like my parents sacrificed so much to make sure that I wouldn't fuck up in life. And I did fuck up a lot. But the one thing they did was buy me this white Squire Bullet Stratocaster. I don't know. It was just like they sacrificed so much. Like that was a lot of money for us. $250 is a fucking shit ton of money. And I bought this little Bullet Strat and a little tiny Squire amp. And I remember...
How old were you?
I would have been 11. I played acoustic guitar a little bit because, like, being Pacific Islander, we always have guitars and music and shit around, you know, like, Pac Islander families are generally pretty musical. But I don't know, something felt different about picking up this, like, kind of heavy thing that you had to plug in to make noise. And I played an A chord and it was like... this fucking abomination of motor-fueled fucking fury blasting out of my amplifier. I don't know.
Like, what made you want to get a guitar?
A lot of things. I'd always dreamed of, like, having an electric guitar. There was a dude in church named Paul who used to play Strat. And I was always kind of fascinated with... Because I used to play drums in church, but I was always kind of fascinated with the electric guitar because one of my first memories was Guns N' Roses' Sweet Child of Mine video clip.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I got a Guns N' Roses tattoo.
Oh, look at that. That's beautiful. Yeah, it's like a skull. It's like a skull with a top hat.
Yeah. I love it, too. But it was just like this... also, Wayne's World as well.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Wayne's World, yeah. You'll never afford it, live in the now. And I was like, fuck that shit, mate. I'm going to get one. So,
yeah, and I used to live in Milwaukee, so that was like one of that was like one of the big.
Can I ask you a question? Is Millie Walkay like? Is the Alice Cooper thing Millie Walkay? Is that actually like what Milwaukee means?
You know, I'm gonna say yes because I'm gonna base it on Wayne's World. I have no. I don't know. I feel like everyone in Milwaukee believes that because of Wayne's World. You know, it's just, so if it's bullshit, then it's. It's like self-perpetuating bullshit at this point.
Milwaukee.
I mean, it sounds right. I think the three socialist mayors part is on a level too.
Three socialist mayors. Yeah, they elected three socialist mayors, didn't they?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's fucking rad. Good on you, Milwaukee.
Yeah. I don't know if they would elect a socialist now, though. You know, it's changed. All right, guys, we're going to get back to this conversation here in a minute. I just want to tell you about another sponsor for today's episode, and that is our friends at Blind Tiger Record Club. Now, what is Blind Tiger Record Club? It is a vinyl record subscription box service delivered to your door each month. You pick from all kinds of different styles, like alternative, singer, songwriter, rock, jazz, soul, blues, whatever you like, and they mail your record selection out at the end of each month. All the vinyl is new, all the 12-inch records are new, some are double albums, they're heavyweight, and some of them are even hard to find import records. The best part of it is the service. Their selections are announced prior to shipping, giving customers the option to choose which album they want each month. Now, subscriptions to the Blind Tiger Record Club start at $25.99, but for listeners of this podcast, we have a special deal. You use the code CELEBRATION at the checkout to receive 50% off your first subscription box. The minimum subscription is 3 months, so the first box is half off, then the following two will be the full price at $25.99. So again, subscribers get member pricing and free shipping on items added to their monthly box. Again, that's the Blind Tiger Record Club, your vinyl, your choice. All right, now let's get back to the podcast. So, like, seeing Sweet Child of Mine video, that was, like, an early memory for you as far as, like, the power of the rock.
Can you just, like, think for a minute, right? Like, his slash, he looks like me. He's half black. Right. And my dad's black. He's got fucking long-ass untamed hair. I had long-ass untamed hair. He's not wearing a fucking shirt. Oh, no, he's wearing, like, a white singlet, like, a white tank top of that. And he's got this low-slung Les Paul. And he's wearing tight black leather pants. He's got a fucking nose piercing. Everything about him is exactly the opposite of how I was raised, you know? But he's sort of me, like, looks like me. And he's got this swagger, this fucking beautiful melodies coming out of that thing. Like, the sound of an overdriven guitar, like, it's like Chipandroids put it really well. It's a Thunder of the Punks guitar that breathes life into a sunken, drunken body or something in the back of a bar. Like, it's that sound of, I don't know, it's a sound of fury and life and, like, every concoction of great feelings and sad feelings incorporated into, like, one chord and a bit of overdrive. Like, I don't know, there's just something, like, contagious. Like, it felt important. Like, that sounds important. Like, it changed the fucking world. Like, and I think I was just kind of caught up in what that sounded like. Like, right. You know, because I loved classical music as a kid. I grew up listening to classical music with my dad and opera. But there was something about the marriage of my love for music and this new thing that I was hearing. I don't know.
For me, too, like, yeah. I have a book coming out in a couple months about classic rock, and like, because I was a huge classic rock head as a kid, and, you know, loving bands that had not even been together for like decades, you know, but I plugged into it. For me, it was always about the mythology of it, which is sort of a double-edged sword, but I love the idea that there was something sort, there was like a continuum of music, you know, because like when we talk about pop music, usually it's about what's ever good today is discarded tomorrow, but like with rock and roll, there's always been this idea that
it's steeped in like tradition, right?
And yeah. You're plugging into something. It's like you're communicating with like the spirits of the past, but then you're also projecting out into the future. And it's like, if you don't believe in God, which I don't anymore, I believe in, like, that's the closest thing to like eternal life.
It's like a Hegelian absolute spirit, you know? It's like this sense of, I don't know, yeah, the mythology part is really, really true, but it feels like that great big spirit in the sky, like this elusive, phenomenological presence, you know, this thing that we can only conceive here, but it exists to so many people as a collective, like, I don't know, it's a really indefinable spirit for me, and I don't like to get too mumbo-jumbo pretentious about it, because I am, but...
I mean, I just was super pretentious before I had... So you can't leave me hanging on, you know, you gotta be pretentious with me right now.
I agree with you, man, like... And I think there's something really bonding about... I always think about, you know... I always think about Mr. Brightside. There are people who could not give a fuck about rock and roll music who know that fucking song. Because there's a fury, there is an urgency, there's an energy, there's an abrasiveness, there's soaring, gorgeous melodies, there's beauty, and there's fear, and there's danger. It feels risky. rock and roll. It always felt like a risk. And I think rock and roll started dying when it stopped being a risk.
Right.
It just had to go back underground and start festering away like a fucking malfunctioning turd. You know?
Well, and also, I mean, going back to the mythology, like the shortcomings of the mythology is like the myth of like the white superhero rock guy, you know, who's like doing lots of drugs and is indestructible and like...
Yeah, that guy's an asshole. That guy's a fucking asshole. I never did anything though. That's a selfish miscreant, you know, and I think that... I'm so sorry to interrupt you.
Well, but I was just going
to
say, I feel like in the last like 5 years or so, rock and roll's been taken over by women, it's been taken over by black and brown people, it's been taken over by, you know, LGBT people, musicians, you know, and I feel like that is totally rejuvenated rock and roll.
It feels like instead of being a whitewashed moment in history, it's starting to become more reflective of its actual black roots. Rock and roll is black music. Let's not forget, all modern music is in some way derived from black music. And I think it's returning to its real organic, earthy place. And the real outsiders, you know? I'm not going to sit here and fucking castigate white people, because, no, look, I love white people. My wife's white. I've got lots of white friends. But the whole point is that, like, rock and roll is not just for white people.
I mean,
feel like a sense of inclusion and antipathy to wrong and antipathy to, like, excluding people, you know? I think that's, like, an incredible... like amazing thing, and like obviously, like look at our band, right? Like there's three people of color. You know, it's a world where we can feel included. Whereas, you know, I mean, you had Phil Wynette and you had Jimi Hendrix and a few other prominent, you know, black men singing, but otherwise it was, you know, most of the artists of the 70s and 80s and 90s are that real kind of like where rock and roll really dominated the charts were all predominantly white.
Well, the thing I realize, like the more I listen to music, the more I read and think about music, so much of this is just based on classification. It's like Funkadelic was making amazing rock records. Eddie Hazel is like one of the great...
Eddie Hazel. Dude, Maga Brain, yeah.
Like, how is that not... That's a rock and roll record. Like, Prince is a great... Like, Purple Rain is like a phenomenal rock record. There's tons of like amazing... guitar solos on that record, is, you know, but like he's not classified as a rock and roll star. It was like for so long, I feel like the gatekeepers, whether they were radio stations or rock critics or record stores, were like, if you're black, you can't make rock music. Like you, or like, you know, like
they applied all these designations to these artists that the artists themselves hadn't welcomed or applied to themselves, and that's like a... I think that's a really dangerous thing, especially when, like, and I can't speak for black artists, you know, especially black guys and black women and black LGBT people, but like it's already decided for a lot of black artists what they are before they open their fucking mouth or play one fucking note, and that's not their fault, and it never was their fault. I think it's the structures in place within the music machine, sort of aligning them with a particular movement or moment for the sake of capitalistic enterprise, rather than actually like an accurate representation of what the art is about.
Right, it's like Frank Ocean. Is he an R&B artist, or is he like making like space age psychedelic soul rock jazz music? You know what I mean? Like,
I get you.
It seems like such a narrow classification of like what he does, based purely on skin color.
Man, like one LA executive once said that I am dark, but not the right kind of dark. You know how fucked up that is?
What does that even mean?
I don't even know what that fucking means. It just means that they're looking to exploit more black artists because that's what culture is looking toward now. It's exploitation. And like, when I think about great artists like Vagabond, like, people who truly defy, or like, there's been Algiers, they're fucking rad. People who defy the stereotypes administered to them, you know, by culture or by the music media or whatever. I think that's a really inspiring start to something that's kind of going to be really fresh and amazing. Like, you go to Australia, there's still a lot of little prominent white artists, but it's really interesting. We have this category called urban, and it's like, what the fuck is urban?
Right.
Like, some of the best hip hop made in Australia is by a guy named Adam Briggs. who's from fucking Shepparton, which is a country town. He's indigenous. He's not fucking, he's from Shepparton. He's not fucking urban. He makes rap music. You know, as and Polynesian culture and black culture are really interchangeable in Australia and also around the west coast of America. Like, to say that a Polynesian person not make like making rap music is somehow not urban is also like a strange designation in of itself. Like, I just feel like there's so many weird connotations underlying all the titles that we give black artists for the sake of consumers rather than, you know, allowing people to self-designate, self-determine. Maybe that's like a pretentious thing to say, but I don't know. Like, right, like being someone who is like obviously being mixed race and being biracial, no, triracial. Like, I don't know, it's like a weird question for me. It's a really weird thing for me. Like, the intersection of race and music in terms of rock and roll's trajectory now is like a fucking fascinating thing. Yeah. Fascinating thing.
Yeah, I just feel like so much of it is just about breaking down imaginary categorizations that have been drilled into people, but they don't really matter. They don't really exist.
So I think it all goes down to the bylines of what we are reading about music, you know, and what we are consuming information and news-wise about it. Yeah. I don't know. I can only theorize. I think our guitar player's probably got a better perception of what, because he's, you know, he's Fijian and he's black, he's a white guy. I think he's got a better perception or a way to explain what this means in terms of like what rock music actually is. Predominantly because he's been into rock and roll since he was a kid, you know, where every other Polynesian or Melanesian or Pacific Islander was into rap music and gospel, you know. I think he's someone who looked at Kelle from Block Party and saw a hero and icon, you know. I think he's someone who probably would have a better perception of it than I am, or than I would, you know.
We were talking about this earlier about, you know, last time you played here, you were playing to 20 people, and now it's a sold-out show, and a lot of the gigs on this tour are sold out, and, I mean, it seems like the record has momentum now, like, people are hearing the record. I know, like, when I talked to you 6 months ago, not a lot of people were talking about it. I mean, and now more people are talking about it.
People talk about it because you talked about it.
Is that, can I take credit?
Dude, I'm going to fucking shout you out tonight, actually. Because yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I will say, like, I think I can say this, that like Seth Meyers and I are like in touch, and I told him that he should book you guys. So, and he read that story. So I'm taking credit for that.
Thank you.
And I actually talked with him a little bit because like we DM on Twitter. Like, I don't want to make it sound like I'm like bros with Seth Meyers, but like we're, you know, we're acquaintances, and like I'm like,
we owe you fucking big time for that shit.
I said that you guys were all extremely nice.
Oh, cool. Fuck yeah. Dude, he like has a really good knowledge of like the DC hardcore punk scene, I guess. Because he knew that all the guys who were on the HG band, like Brendan Canty fucking played drums that night. I got to meet him. That was sick. And Marnie Stern plays guitar. It's fucking amazing.
Yeah.
What a band.
He's like a huge music fan and like the nicest dude like in the world. He's just like a regular guy.
We only got to meet him for like 10 seconds, but he came and said hi, and it was really nice of him to do that. So it was fucking weird. Like, that late night TV thing was petrified me, but now, I don't know, having done it, it felt pretty rewarding actually doing it. I don't know if our performance is any good. I haven't watched it, but I don't know.
Well, that was great. Like, you were like, you're going for it. Like, the thing I said, like, when I saw it was like, this looks like a band that's like, we're going to be the last rock band to play on television. So we're doing, there was like a, like an apocalyptic energy to it, which I loved.
Dude, I always go into something fully believing that it could be the very last time I ever get to do it.
Right.
You know, I think that's the way forward for me.
So, I mean, what's the difference now? Like, aside from like my ringing endorsement, like why do you think it's catching on now?
I don't know. Because of Spotify, I think, man. Spotify and Apple Music. Word of mouth.
Yeah.
I don't know how the mechanics of American music taste work. I don't know how to interpret any of the success, man. It's just like a, I don't know.
You're supposed to say because I'm a genius and people have finally noticed.
No, that's the thing. I think because I recognize how far from a genius I truly am, I might have actually stumbled across something that could be like potentially effective. You know, we've never had a sense of fulfillment with what we've done, because everything that we've done is shit in comparison to the next thing we want to do. And maybe I think people are detecting that there's a sense of ambition and a desire to mean something and a desire to create big, enormous, like important things, like ongoing. Maybe that's that. I don't know if people are just tired of low stakes shit. I hope they are.
I mean, I don't know. Like, everyone I've told about this record, like, I mean, I wrote about it, obviously, but, like, you know, I'll tell people, like, oh, you should check out this record. And I feel like it's one of those, it's like an airborne virus type record. Like, if you expose them to the record, it will get into their system and they really like it. I mean, I feel like it's just a matter of people actually hearing about it. And then once they're actually, you know, they've heard about the record, they hear it, then they get into it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think when anyone listens to our album, they hear something that in some way speaks to them and where they're at, speaks right to the heart of who they are and what they're doing. And I think that, like I was talking about before, but these binding commonalities and anxieties that really unite all of us in a sense of shared loss and longing, a sense of shared, like, grief and purpose. Like, it's so weird how much we lack collectively in terms of confidence and in terms of security, and how much just talking about that is really cathartic for people. You know, maybe people just want to gravitate towards something that resonates, really resonates. You know, like, whether it be self-doubt or a baby dying or losing faith in structures or gods, or whether it's just trying to defeat apathy with a sense of, like, enthusiasm.
I mean, or just having a record take over your life is, like, pretty awesome. To be like, oh, like, you want to hear the Joshua Tree or Appetite for Destruction or Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, or
Melancholy. You want to hear Melancholy.
You know, just a record that's like, okay, this is like my friend for a while. It's like next to me in the chair, and we're just going to ride shotgun for a while.
I think people are going to feel that way about Contra by Vampire Weekend, or Boxer by The National, or Funeral by Arcade Fire, or, you know, just the big indie rock albums that really meant something.
Yeah.
They're like, just captured for a moment the zeitgeist beating heart of what a generation of people in 2018 or whatever were feeling back in 2007.
Then those records still walk with you too.
Yeah, the records that reveal themselves to you with each listen in this kind of new, unfolding, manifold kind of way. I always feel that way about The Wall by Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
Also, most of Daniel Johnston's work reveals itself. Daydream Nation still has surprises for me, man. The Monitor by Titus Andronicus, The Seer by Swans. I think gargantuan or not, the albums that matter are the ones that try to matter to people, that aren't filled with apathy and shrugging of shoulders and staring at fucking shoes. You know, Yankee Hotel Foxtrot was an attempt to really mean something. They went from Summer Teeth, which is almost power pop in a lot of ways, to something that catalogued pain and anxiety and these non-sequiturs and kind of stream of consciousness rambling about assassinating down the avenue, you know.
Well, and then, like, they make it before 9/11, and then, like, 9/11 happens, and there's all these references to, like, buildings shaking, and it's like, how the fuck does that happen? It's like something's in the air.
It's getting hot in the poor places tonight.
Right.
I'm not going outside.
Right.
I've got reservations about so many things, but not about, like, it's, I think there was something, like, I think Jeff Tweedy's something of an oracle, weirdly, and I think he doesn't know how important his words will be in 50 years' time.
Yeah.
Like, the way we think about bands like The Band or Steely Dan,
right,
we're going to be like, that was Wilco.
Yeah.
You know?
So I know you got to go get ready for the show, do your pre-show prep. Like, do you have a pre-show routine, by the way? Do you, like...
I warm up and steam and drink a lot of water, and then we get together in a group and we huddle and we do a little thing, and that's our thing.
All right, man. Great talk with you, Dave.
Bye, America.
All right, that was me and Dave from Gang of Youths. Good dude, great band. See them live. Get the record. Go farther in lightness. I'm telling you, I think this band... you know, they're playing the sellout tour in America right now. I have a feeling they're going to be playing larger venues in, later in the year. So if you want to see this band in a small club, see them now. It might be your last chance. Guys, thanks again for listening. Thank you so much for your support. I want to do a shout out to the man that makes it happen, Derek Madden. Thank you for putting together the episodes. Also, shout out to Josh Copperman for writing our theme song. And guys, thanks again for supporting the podcast, being great listeners, and talking about us on iTunes and social media and doing all the things to help spread the word about the podcast and helping us to grow and have great conversations about music. It's what it's all about. Thanks again, guys. We will talk to you again next week.
On the Westwood One Podcast Network.